Hi everyone, and welcome to another edition of Bina 007 Movie Reviews. The big review of the week is Star Wars The Last Jedi, and to review that I'm joined by my friend Patrick, also known as Sir Patrick the Tall, on the Vassals of Kingsgrave podcast, which is a community-hosted podcast I often contribute to. It covers all manner of geeky and nerdy things, so if you want to hear me discuss stuff that isn't movie-related, I would encourage you to go there, check out vokpodcast.wordpress.com. After Patrick and I discuss Star Wars in full spoiler detail, I am then going to give a quick review of actually another film starring Mark Hamill that's out right now called Brigsby Bear, and then round out with a quick review of the film Stronger, which is about the Boston Marathon bombing survivor Jeff Bauman. Okay, so here's a clip of the new Star Wars film to get us going on the show.
Breathe. Now, reach out. What do you see?
Light. Darkness. And something else. It's calling me.
Resist it, Rey.
This has been a 007, and I'm joined by Patrick.
Hello, Patrick the Tall.
And we're here to discuss The Last Jedi. So can you just quickly let me know what your thoughts were? Because I don't know if you're positive, negative, in between. It seems to be a very divisive edition.
It definitely was. I think I was mainly one of the most staunch supporters of... Of the choices. I mean, I understand why people think that some of these things are out of place and stuff, but I generally enjoyed it, and I think that it does very well what I think it's supposed to do, which is introduce Star Wars, or like introduce new characters as the main characters from now on.
I agree. We're in a transitional phase, aren't we, where some of the old characters need to be pensioned off and the new ones brought to the forefront. So I agree with that. How do you rate it compared to The Force Awakens and Rogue One, so the sort of the new Disney era Star Wars?
Oh, yeah. Well, I would definitely do Rogue One as my favorite, then this one, and then Force Awakens as my least favorite one.
Okay. So for me, it's the same. Like, Rogue One is definitely my favorite. It may well be my favorite film, including Empire. I just think it's so dark. It's so lovely to see a film without Skywalkers and lightsabers. That's a great film to me. And I think in a sense that probably set me up for a fall with this one, because nothing was going to be as good as that for me. I really had a great time watching The Force Awakens, but I think in retrospect felt it was so fan servicey. But I got why, because I think the prequels were so bad, they kind of had to earn back our love.
Maybe, yeah.
And I think in The Force Awakens, they showed they loved it as much as we did, almost maybe too much. And so I was really looking forward to this one, because I felt it'll be interesting to see if they push it forward into new territory. And they totally did that, right? So I can't criticize it for that. To me, it was like, I did enjoy it. I didn't not enjoy it. It wasn't the overwhelming positive experience I had with Force Awakens and Rogue One. And there were real jump the shark moments that really took me out of the film. And even while watching it the first time, rather than being immersed in it, I was like analyzing, this is an interesting choice. This provokes me. Let me think about why I like that. And I just feel that I love a film that's intelligent enough to do that to me, but I don't want that to happen during the film. In the film, I should be Star Wars and wrapped up in it. But should we get to some of the points of controversy, and you can maybe explain to me what I'm getting wrong.
I'm not going to explain to you what you're getting wrong. That's the wrong attitude.
Well, I'm pleased for that, actually, because so many people have been sending me articles written in different magazines trying to kind of explain the black backlash or explain to me why I haven't gotten it. And that's almost like more annoying than what I didn't like in the film.
I mean, it's basically useless to try to move people's point of view without it being like something they want to do themselves, you know, explore new territory. So in that sense, I don't never really enjoy explaining stuff to people, so to say, why they need to like a thing.
But that's, we can go through the different plot strands, and I guess. Talk about it. So I think that's kind of, I was trying to split this up. I think there's four separate things going on here.
Yeah.
So the first one is probably kind of in the order of how it's introduced, is the space battle between the First Order and what remains of the Resistance. Because as we open, or rather at the end of The Force Awakens, Coruscant has been destroyed by the Starkiller base. So when we open this film, we've got to assume that the Republic is gone. And they're chasing what remains of the Resistance fleet, which is running out of fuel. We discover they can track people through light speed, which is kind of weird and new, but cool. We get a really cool new ship. I love the Dreadnought. I love seeing the tech evolve. That is, to me, the best of Star Wars. Oh my God, it's a new ship. It looks so awesome. And you get this brilliant slow motion chase through space. And it's setting us up for a lesson that Poe has to go through, because he starts off as his hero jock. And he has to understand that sometimes courage and heroism is about humility and not caring what people think about you and making a sacrifice. So he does that in opposition to Leia and to Vice Admiral Holdo. And I have to say, I loved that opening scene. I loved the character of Paige. And I was really, even the second time I watched it, I was on the edge of my seat. Like, is she going to get that remote control to set off the bombs? And I really liked that storyline, that Poe could be made from this one-dimensional pilot into something more serious. The only thing I felt in that is, you know, like, and this is just because he's my all-time favorite minor character is Admiral Akbar. And I felt he just got like this really lame death off screen. And I just felt maybe he should have gone down either piloting one of the fleet ships so he could have a sacrificial death like that befits his life. But why couldn't he have played the Holdo character? I mean, I've got nothing against Laura Dern, but I just felt that would have been a fitting death for him.
Yeah, that's a very valid opinion to have. I think that the only thing I would say against that is that it would be difficult for Admiral Akbar to express all the emotions that Holdo expresses.
Because he has a rubber mask rather than a
face.
Actually, yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe that's a good counterpoint. But anyway, maybe because, you know, there's the captain of the ship, not the medical frigate, but there's another one where they manage to get the people off and he stays on it and gets killed. And I think that would have been a good death for Akbar. Put him on a secondary ship, have him save the lives of the people by staying on, and then go.
Definitely.
It's a minor point, though. It's a totally minor point.
That one.
But I love that scene. I love that whole storyline. I think the secondary storyline that it spawns, which is the one where Poe sends Finn and Rose, who I loved as a new character, off to Canto Bight. And they meet the code breaker played by Benicio del Toro, because there's this kind of like totally convoluted plot whereby they need to get the code breaker because they need to get on the Imperial ship because they need to deactivate the light speed tracker so that everyone can get away. But they don't really need to get away anyway because they're going to a rebel base. But Poe doesn't know that. Like, what did you think of all that? Like, did you like Rose? Did you like the Canto Bight scenes? They seem to be like some of the most controversial, I would say.
Well, I don't mind the Canto Bight scenes. I think that it did give us a sort of a break right after all the death and disparity that was in that first, you know, scene between the First Order and the Resistance. So I like that they kind of got us, give us a respite there. But I controversially am not as interested in Rose as a character.
Oh, interesting.
Just because she's basically too cute. Like, she's her whole shtick is being cute and being the moral compass, right?
Yeah, and this is the problem that I think the actress that plays Rose I really liked.
Yeah.
I like the fact that she's powerful and delivers a powerful message, but she has this very delicate voice, and it's a different kind of heroine rather than like Rey, who's very active. You know, it's a very, she's more passive, and I like that. But she makes this very bold choice at the end to ram Finn off, which I really loved. But I agree with you that there's an element to both Holdo and to Rose where they're just that movie trope of these women who exist purely to teach men a lesson. So Holdo exists absolutely purely to teach Poe about the nature of true leadership. And basically, Rose exists to give Finn maybe a love interest and to teach him that, rather than giving in to the cynicism that the Codebreaker might have inspired in him and hatred, he needs to live and live for love and for the light side of the Force. That's all the reason for Rose to exist. And in a series with so many cool female characters like Leia, like Rey, it's kind of like, yeah, they still can't quite escape that, you know, wise woman existing to teach, suffering women that teach the hero to be a better hero character.
Yeah, exactly. I just don't enjoy that specifically. I wouldn't even enjoy having a man, male character that was... You know, I don't enjoy paladin characters, basically. That's the kind of characters I don't enjoy. The ones who are morally centered and always will do the right thing, even if they try to, like, with story, try to give you, like, a lure you into a trap thinking something else, they still turn out to be the moral compass of the story. And
always
I don't like
good,
that.
Always right. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And that maybe nicely brings us to the third plot strand, which is Luke and Rey, because I guess Luke was that character in the early films, the paladin character.
Yeah.
And now he's in despair and he's closed himself off from the Force, and he acknowledges that Jedi have always failed training people that are very powerful Force users and keeping them away from the dark side.
Mm.
And I really like that, actually. I like that he's cynical and that he also has a lesson to learn. And Yoda, I guess, teaches him that lesson. That failure is okay, that there's a teaching moment, quote unquote, in that. How did you feel about that? Because I think a lot of the fans have freaked out that Luke's in despair, basically.
Yeah, I think that's what I've also found out later on, that a lot of people don't like that he's actually been shown to be human, basically. As a fan of George R. R. Martin's universe, I think that's basically what drew me into that these characters could be three-dimensional and can make mistakes and then still be good guys in the end after they get out of their whatever crisis they have. So that's totally acceptable and maybe one of the best things of this film.
Yeah, I love it. And I think that it would almost be psychopathic if you train your nephew and he turns to the dark side and kills all your other Jedi pupils. It would almost be bizarre not to have that reaction.
Yeah.
And I always think it's weird when you look back on it in retrospect that the kind of, you know, the fluffy, happy Alec Guinness Obi-Wan isn't more scarred by what has happened with Anakin. And that's probably because, you know, George hadn't worked it all out at that point. But, you know, it feels like that weight should be there. I mean, I also like the Yoda reaction, which is stop beating yourself up about it. There's still hope. There's still light. And that fits with his more mischievous character. But, you know, when we meet Yoda, he's very reluctant to teach Luke as well and is hiding out kind of for the same reasons. And to me, that I don't understand how true Star Wars fans can kind of get upset about that, because that seems to me an element that's been there from the very start in Yoda, that weariness, not weariness, wariness, that the Force is Force and the danger of teaching people.
Yeah.
So I loved it. I mean, I had issues with the execution of it and kind of the humor in the film. And I know that Star Wars has always been super funny and I loved it. And I love 3PO and R2 and Han Solo and the comedy there. And I love the comedy and all the sidekicks. So I like the kind of the Poe Dameron and BB-8 humor. BB-8 is brilliantly funny. I just felt that with Luke, I don't need Luke to make funny little comments like, oh yeah, Jakku is a backwater, but why are you here? If Luke's going to have this truly provocative, despairing storyline, he doesn't necessarily, for me, need to have the witty one-liners. They can happen in the comic relief scene. So I found that, I didn't find Luke's despair jarring. I found his kind of Iron Man humor jarring, personally. But did you mind it? Like, you know, the scene where he throws the lightsaber off over his shoulder? I get why they were doing that, because it's a very shocking, powerful image of him rejecting the Force. But to me, that felt really uncomfortable. Like, is that really how he would express it? It was almost like in the cinema where I was watching it, people were sort of laughing at it. It just made me very uncomfortable. But how did you react to all of that?
I guess I see, and this is probably not the right way to do it, but I can't separate Mark Hamill with Luke. And Mark Hamill, his humor is like that. So I wasn't surprised at all that he would do stuff like that. And I found it, well, in any case, for me, it's basically just they also trying to simulate the whole Yoda on a distant planet becoming sort of a unlikable hermit to begin with, and ending up being the master that teaches the most important lessons to the new Padawan. So I understand why they wanted to kind of give him that way of being, I mean, humorously uncharismatic.
Yeah, sort of eccentric. He's lost touch a little bit, and he's sort of awkward in because that's probably, I guess, the first time he's seen a human for quite some time, because he's just living basically with porgs and those weird nun creatures. I kind of get it, and I kind of respect the choice they made. It just didn't work for me. Mm. And it didn't work for me in quite a violent way. Like, it really took me out. In the same way that Leia kind of going out into space and then force using her way back, to me, was a very jump the shark moment. It really took me out, because she's always had some force sensitivity, so I can see maybe why you can justify that. But it just felt like we've never been prepared for her having that power and surviving, and it just felt a little bit cheap.
Not in the regular canon anymore, but she does have force powers in the extended universe to a certain extent. She was in the books, she was taught by Luke for a bit.
I don't know. It just feels like, I mean, and I read the EU and I love it.
Yeah.
I just feel the EU can give you misdirects as well. Like, why did we get a whole big Phasma book and then Phasma gets about 2 seconds of screen time? That's forgettable. Like, I just feel the films should stand on their own. And I think if you'd only watched the films, that would be very shocking. It was shocking to me, actually, just to see it. Mm. I was just like, what? And the same with, like, the Jedi mind melds. Like, oh, so live Jedi users can just mind meld and not just talk to Force ghosts? That's the thing? Okay. It's like, I get tech moving forward. I get you now have a dreadnought. I get you now have miniaturized Death Star tech and a battering ram and all that bullshit. Mm. But does the Force really progress to a point where there was this cool thing that could happen that we never knew before?
Well, I don't think it's a progression, actually. Well, I don't know. I consolidated with my knowledge of Star Wars with the game. There's a Star Wars Old Republic game, Knights of the Old Republic game, where one of the Force users can use something called battle meditation, where she basically links all the Force users' minds together so that they act in unison on the battlefield. And I thought that was just...
Okay. But again, like, if you've never seen it, if you've never played that game, it's like, what? And that combined with, like, the layer thing, it's like, seriously, you're rewriting the rules of the Force? And then even, like, so is there precedent in the EU for Luke being able to sort of astral project to a whole different planet? And interact with people.
Not as far as I know. But again, I think that was basically why Supreme Leader Snoke was able to do it to begin with, like, connect those two. Because, you know, there was also the whole aspect of, I think it was Kylo got wet from the spray of the water or something like that. I think they kind of introduced it that way so that it wouldn't be so jarring when Luke did it.
I don't mind that Luke does it, because I think, A, it's a beautiful ending. Like, I thought that was a beautiful ending for his character. It was genuinely shocking. The idea that he's at peace, he's not going to be a Jedi cut down in anger in a fight.
Mm.
He's actually going to have conquered his own anger and despair and die on his own terms. Mm. And I love the fact that he got a goodbye with Carrie Fisher, that beautiful hand-holding scene, and that he is a Jedi who, up until Rey and Kylo, is the most powerful one, and that he can do something maybe the other Jedis couldn't. I mean, I love all that. That it's not a problem for me, but it was just like, it just felt like that and a few other things together were like, oh, so the rules of the Force are being changed now. Okay.
Definitely. I'm thinking that, but it's also important for me, at least, to see an evolution of all the aspects that you like. It's not... Or at least, you could do that, evolve the Force powers, make them add more on. But you can also, and a counterpoint for that could probably also be that you could just find new and ingenious ways to use the already existing Force powers.
Agree.
So, I mean, there's two camps in that, I think.
To me, it all comes down to, does it forward the narrative? Does it serve the narrative? And I think Luke using those new powers very much advances the narrative and gives us real emotional resonance in some scenes. And to me, that makes it good. I think the Leia kind of getting knocked out of the ship, but being alive, but in a coma, only exists so that Holdo can be given power and be in opposition to Poe.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, that felt to me a bit more like we needed some plot tech to make this character necessary. So that felt a bit cheaper.
And I agree that is actually, I mean, of those two expressions of the Force, I enjoy Luke's much better, much more than I do with Leia's. Also, just because I was expecting her to die, because, well, we know that Carrie Fisher is dead, and what's going to happen next episode of Star Wars.
Yeah, so it was a great subversion. But I like that even though they didn't kill her, they did give... Rian Johnson, as a director, does like his close-ups on people's faces, and he chose good actors, which is good. And there was a beautiful kind of goodbye scene between Leia and Holdo, and then another between Leia and Luke. And as it turns out, which is a brilliant surprise for us, it's Holdo and Luke that are the ones that die. But it still gives you, as someone who comes to the film knowing that Carrie Fisher is dead, this beautiful goodbye. Yeah. And I felt that was really elegant. And also, I just think, compared to the first movie, they really figured out her hair and makeup, and she looks so beautiful in this film, so regal. And carries that burden of carrying on the resistance. And I just thought it was a magisterial, regal performance for her. I really, really loved it. Which I guess brings us to, so we've done Rey and Luke. So the final plot strand is kind of Rey and Kylo force connecting, and then her voluntarily going to face Snoke. And I think that, to me, this, as Song of Ice and Fire fans, this really reminded me of Melisandre, because both Rey and Snoke misinterpret visions. So Rey sees Kylo killing Snoke and thinks, oh, he's going to turn to the light side, I need to make that happen. And Snoke sees him cutting down his quote-unquote greatest enemy, which actually turns out to be Snoke. So it kind of made me laugh that both of them had sort of misinterpreted Kylo's future and feelings, and you end up with Kylo as Supreme Leader. How did you like that whole story arc?
Yeah, I was sitting at the edge of my seat wondering what was going to happen, because I couldn't figure it out. And that's good movie making right there.
Yep.
I mean, I usually am able to figure storylines out quite quickly, because I immersed myself in the art of doing that in role playing and other stuff. So to be able to actually figure out what was going to happen in the end and how to do it, that is a very good sign right there. When we ended up with the whole where he described that Kylo wanted to cut his greatest enemy down, by that moment I had figured out that.
Oh really? I totally didn't. The first time I watched it, I totally had not figured that out, and it was just brilliantly surprising.
Was also something about camera angles.
Yeah,
you saw him and you could see the lightsaber right next to him, and I kind of figure out that best Darth Vader moment he would betray his master.
And then we get like probably one of the all-time greatest lightsaber battles with Kylo and Rey versus all the first Supreme Leader's hands against this very kind of, you know, very simple red backdrop for Star Wars. It's almost like something out of Kurosawa. It's so good.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I really, really enjoy the color choices of this movie. I mean, going from these bright, bright red backdrops from the First Order and the white, almost super clean backdrops from the Resistance ships. And then you go to the casino planet where it's gold
black and white.
Yeah. And so all those color choices, they really, really make me enjoy it from a cinematic perspective.
I agree. And I really loved what I call the Helm's Deep scene, where they're in the rebel base at the end with the giant door. And this idea to have the layer of white salt on the red earth.
Yes.
Was number one, it's visually stunning as you see the red reveal. But number two, there's this great theme in this film. One of them is about learning from failure and humility. But another one is about the true cost of war. And, you know, Finn is seeing that through seeing arms dealers, and we're seeing slavery. But we're also, through Leia's grieving reaction to seeing that bomber fleet destroyed early on, you know, the cost, like she's looking at screens and seeing people die. And I think seeing that pristine white in front of that gate become progressively more red and slushy and almost like bloody is a beautiful visual metaphor for, we love this battle between light and dark, but there's this human cost. And I think that's what this film is trying to tell us. There's this real stakes to this. And I loved how that was communicated visually. So beautiful.
Yes, basically, most of the lesson we as viewers are supposed to learn is the same lessons that Poe Dameron is going through. That
exactly.
That this Star Wars isn't just people, these paragons going gung-ho into the den of evil and, winning at the end. It's there's also a lot of sacrifices that until now hasn't really been addressed too much, and that this is basically Hoth, but for me it's bloody
yeah.
Hoth.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bloody Hoth. It's Hoth with all the wages and all the earnings of battle visually seen, which is fantastic.
So yeah.
Yeah, great. I like that there's a positive ending to this, because I feel that my reaction was so puzzled when I came out. And like I said, there were things that I really don't like, choices that for me just don't work in this film. Luke having that level of humor, some of the forced choices. To me, Canto Bight, I just felt was redundant. And Benicio del Toro, I don't mind him as a character. It just felt like that whole thing I could have lost. There were lots of things that really pulled me out of this movie and made me really not like it. But then again, there are things that I think are beautiful and are so in keeping with the Star Wars universe and so visually brilliant and moving that I loved it. And the messages of it are fantastic. So,
yeah. Also, just that we can talk so much about all these different aspects and have a very discussion about why it was there, also from a narrative way, but also what effect it has on the world and what we feel about those effects. That there are it takes so long just to think about all the aspects and all the scenes and how they affected one is, for me, a sign of a good movie, a very good movie.
I agree. And I think there are three fantasy universes that I'm deeply invested in. One is Star Wars, one is Lord of the Rings, and the third is A Song of Ice and Fire. And I think that's what all three of them have in common, is they really bear the weight of profound discussion. And you can have differing opinions about how they're shown on screen, but they're just these beautiful universes to get lost in. And like I said when I came out, it wasn't my favorite film. I had problems with it, but any Star Wars film makes me happy. And I think a lot of these are bold choices, and we talk about this a lot in the context of A Song of Ice and Fire, that a lot of us had problems with The Dance with Dragons, the latest installment there, but until you see the payoff, you can't really judge it. But I am looking forward, because I know the final episode is directed by J.J. Abrams. So it's going to be interesting to see whether, you know, Rian Johnson overturned a lot of what he did. So is J.J. Abrams then going to respect that and carry it forward? I'd almost, even though I enjoyed this film less, I'd almost rather Rian Johnson was doing the next one to see truly where his vision was kind of getting to.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the weirdness of these trilogies directed by lots of different people, I think.
Yeah, and I definitely appreciate that he tried something new and something different with this universe in a mainline film, just so that we can reflect on the universe from a different perspective. It's just, I commend him for his effort. And even though, yes, there were a few things that were puzzling why it was done in that specific way, the whole of the movie and its effect on people's discussion of Star Wars as a whole, but also just as of the saga's evolution, makes it worth it. I think he did a very good job. Hoping to see more from him.
Well, you will, right? Because he's been given a new trilogy by Kathleen Kennedy in the Star Wars universe. So we're going to get a lot of Rian Johnson Star Wars stuff coming up.
Very good.
I think on balance, like, to me, the negatives were probably weighing on me more than the positives, but it still isn't a negative review. I mean, I still think this is a very interesting, fascinating film in the franchise. And, you know, I enjoyed The Force Awakens more, but maybe this is in some respects the more provocative and therefore the better film. It stayed with me. It's asked, you know, the first one was a much easier watch because it was what we had experienced before. So it slipped down very easy, like baby food. Whereas this one is more adult fare and needs a bit more chewing over. So that's no bad thing either.
But then again, you don't really, in comparison to what I could have expected from a person that had more felt it negatively to begin with, you don't express it, you haven't expressed it that much.
My negativity? No, I did. I mean, I did on kind of like, you know, the Facebooks when I first came out of the film.
Because
the negative shock is what stays with you most immediately. And then I think the positives, like the structural integrity of it, is what comes through later. And I think that is the reason why I watched this first a week ago now. And there's a reason why it took me a week both to write my review and to talk about it. Because I really wanted to let it settle, watch it again. And I'm sure as the years evolve, I'll think about it differently too. But it wasn't the immediate, I love this, that Rogue One was, but, you know, it's just a complicated and long film, and it's a complicated and long reaction.
So do you agree that there's quite a possibility that, like, in reverse of how you reacted to The Force Awakens, where you started out, and I personally also started out being very positive and very happy when I came out of the cinema, and then started realizing that, well, this is the reason why I liked it was because it's basically the first number four of the movies has already made. It was basically A New Hope.
No, I think the difference is that I realized it was A New Hope even when I was watching it. And okay. I was loving it for that very consciously. Mm-hmm. And I was loving that J.J. Abrams had taken the time to show me that he loved A New Hope. And that was very instantaneous. So okay. The fan service-y stuff that I don't like about it, I didn't like about it from the start. But it was like, to me, that was like a 90% I love it and 10% it is a bit. And it's kind of like almost like a self-criticism. I wanted this fan service and I've got what I wanted, so I'm an idiot, right? But whereas I feel that with Star Wars The Last Jedi, it's been 50-50, like really 50-50 from the start. Okay. And it's just I've expressed the negative publicly first and now I'm expressing it more nuanced. But we'll see. We'll see. And I think, honestly, like, if this really pays off in the final act, maybe, like Empire, this will become something that I like even more, because we'll see the fruits of it. I just want to see in the final one all these sidekicks like 3PO and R2 and Chewie, who don't really have a point now that their masters are dead, need to go. And these new characters need to come to the floor four. And we need to have that. This trilogy will be ultimately judged on that Rey-Kylo conflict in the last film.
Yeah.
And what outcome they decide to give to it.
Yeah.
And until then, everything else is on hold, I think, a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I basically, I started out maybe 90% liking the Force Awakens and then going maybe down to 50% because I actually didn't enjoy watching it several times that much, because of the, it was, seemed like I've already watched that movie like 100 times. I enjoyed it less. And this one, the more I reflect upon it, the more I like it. And
oh, that's good though. That's really cool. I'm glad you're getting more and more out of it.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, I think we managed to do a very...
Balanced.
Yeah.
I'm glad we came to a response that's positive. And cool. Well, thank you very much for joining, Patrick. If you want to hear more of Patrick, as I said, check out VOK, Vassals of Kingsgrave. And other than that, on with the show. Here's a quick clip from Brigsby Bear before I review that film.
Everything's very big. It's really very big.
The reason you're here, the reason I'm here, is all just to help you.
Everyone says they're trying to help me, but nobody can find me the new episode of Brigsby.
There wasn't a new episode this week. This is about moving on with the rest of your life.
Try to imagine a hero.
Just be normal, all right?
Hi, I'm James. I really like your clothes.
He's not on the bad side. He's on the good side.
Brigsby Bear is a really heartwarming dark comedy that has elements of great films such as Napoleon Dynamite, Room, and Be Kind Rewind. It's about a young man called James, who's played by Saturday Night Live's Carl Mooney, who is returned to his family after being abducted as a child and raised by a couple of cranks, the father of which is played by Mark Hamill. He's really struggling to adjust to reality, which you would absolutely imagine is true, and he actually misses the cocooned world in which he lived. And part of the ruse by which his fake parents kept him in that world was to proclaim that the world was a very dark and dangerous place, and they did this or reinforced these messages by creating a completely fake TV show called Brigsby Bear. And when he gets out of his enforced prison, James is absolutely shocked that no one else has seen Brigsby Bear. He is utterly ingrained in the mythos of it. He's its number one audience member and superfan. And with the help of a friendly cop played by Greg Kinnear, he manages to get back a lot of the costumes and stage scenery that his fake parents had used. And together with his newfound high school friends, he manages to recreate the show, which is very key to his emotionally accepting his past and finding a place in his new family. I found the film to be really laugh out loud funny and very goofy, and I thought the cameo from Mark Hamill as the fake dad was really funny. But beyond a kind of Napoleon Dynamite indie movie humour, I thought the film was really insightful about the modern nature of internet-fueled fandom. And in the words of LCD Sound System, the, quote, fake nostalgia for an unremembered 80s that South Park recently so brilliantly satirized with its Member Berries plotline. Because James is not just someone who watched Briggs Be Bear, he has kept them all on meticulously labeled VHS tapes. He discusses the shows in online forums that his fake parents have faked up and become fake people that he chats with. And he even wears like a fake faded fan t-shirt from Briggs Be Bear. And so much of the way in which he's been sucked into that fandom mirrors the worst excesses of what Patrick and I and many others experience with our online fandoms when we get really involved in nitpicking shows and obsessed with plot twists and characters. So I think it really speaks to the way in which current generations really get immersed in self-consciously old school lo-fi pop culture. And I like the fact that this film is both funny and actually quite moving, but contains a little bit of social satire too. So I'd really strongly recommend Briggs Be Bear. It's got a running time of 97 minutes and it's rated PG-13. It opened earlier this year in the USA and Canada and is open as of last week in the UK and Ireland. Now for something completely different, here's a little clip from the Boston Marathon bombing movie Stronger.
Listen up. This young lady here is running the marathon for bringing a women's hospital. So skip around to Sterling and donate to a good cause.
Yay! I'm going to be there at the finish line for you.
I'm going to make a big sign for you.
Doesn't show up for anything. And then he shows up.
There was an explosion, and your legs, they're gone, bro.
Welcome home. Is it good to be back?
What are you doing?
Talking to you. What are you doing?
Dancing.
You're trying to make a hero out of me.
You need to tell your family what's going on with you.
So Stronger is the new film from a director I really admire called David Gordon Green. It's a biopic of Jeff Bauman, who was a young man who went to support a friend of his who was running in the Boston Marathon and had his legs blown off in the bombing. He was captured in a very iconic photograph being wheeled off in a wheelchair by a man in a cowboy hat, and became a kind of symbol of triumph in adversity. You would hear people using the phrase Bauman Strong as well as Boston Strong. And he was quite literally wheeled out at big sporting events after the bombing, waving the American flag and seen as a symbol of a city triumphing over adversity. But actually, behind the scenes, what we get in this film is a picture of a man really struggling to come to terms with his new disability, his struggle just to walk again, to be in his mother's flat and to use the bathroom, and really basic stuff. And also the struggle that his girlfriend, Erin, has in putting her life on hold and her job on hold to become his carer when she doesn't get on with a mum. And when his girlfriend becomes pregnant, Jeff's reluctance to both accept the public role as the symbol of this crisis, but also to accept the private role of being a dependable boyfriend and father. So it's a relatively straightforwardly told film, deceptively so actually. I think Jake Gyllenhaal gives a really strong performance as Jeff Bauman. I think he totally conveys the frustrations and the conflicted feelings about having to deal with this deeply traumatic thing in a very public manner. I felt a little sorry for Tatiana Maslany, who I think is a very talented actress, obviously from Orphan Black, the TV show. I think she has very little to do in this film except just be supportive and be on the verge of tears. And I found the rest of the cast slightly odd in a sense. Miranda Richardson, the great British actress, plays Jeff's alcoholic mum. And I'm not sure if anyone from Boston is listening to this and can attest to whether her accent is convincing, but I just felt it was a little phony, a little obviously off. And it just felt that David Gordon Green was probably trying to portray that kind of loud, obnoxious extended family that we see in other very famous Boston films such as The Fighter or even pastiched, hopefully self-consciously, in the TV show Wahlburgers. But it just kind of felt flat here, and I feel I've seen that too often. Even if that was the real thing, I feel that it was shown in a way that just felt cliched rather than authentic and real. I think the real star of the film, actually, or the really interesting part of the film, is how Jeff connects with the guy who actually was wheeling him out in the cowboy hat. And that particular man's story is incredibly moving and became for me perhaps the most authentic and moving part of the film, despite the fact that it's meant to be about Jeff Powellman. And so while it's by no means a perfect film and there were the things about it that brought me out of the viewing experience, I was actually crying by the end of watching it. And I think the emotional payoff is worth some of the more unsuccessful directorial choices. That said, I watched it knowing very little about Jeff Bauman, and since then I have read the book on which the film was based. And what's fascinating about that is that the book is very slippery about what I've now discovered are great controversies about Jeff Bauman, principally about what he remembers, how he remembered it, how he ID'd the bomber from the photo, and also about the sheer amount of money that has been donated to him and the ethics around some of that. Yes, I just wish that maybe the film had had the bravery to tackle some of those controversies in a head-on manner and more transparently than the book did. Because I think then you would have had a truly gritty film with real insight rather than what is ultimately a feel-good movie, bizarrely, right? I mean, it shows you Jeff Bauman battling against being a symbol of hope. But ultimately, this is a movie about him being a symbol of hope, and that's the message we're meant to get. And it's also slightly bizarre that you end the film with him being, you know, basically in a good place. Like, he's learned to walk again, he's found some purpose, he's with the beautiful Erin, he has a baby. And yet we know, as the viewers, that he's since been divorced. So there's something just slightly off about the film. I think it does work emotionally despite that. David Gordon Green's just a good enough filmmaker that that's going to be the case. It's worth a watch. It's not necessarily the greatest film ever made. Stronger has a running time of 116 minutes. It was open earlier this year in the USA and was released in the UK on December 8th. And I still think it's worth checking out if you need something to watch at the cinema. Okay, so that's been an extended edition of Being a 007 Movie Reviews. I think Star Wars is the big film. I hope you guys really enjoy it when you go see it. Brigsby Bear, definitely worth checking out if you want that side dish of art house Mark Hamill. And whatever you choose to watch over the Christmas holidays, I hope you have fun watching it. I hope you have a great holiday season, and I look forward to speaking with you all in the new year. Thanks for listening.